From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It's a good thing Tim Noakes established an impeccable reputation as a scientist before he started going after so many sacred cows. Over the last several years, Noakes has challenged the conventional thinking on how the body regulates athletic endurance, for example. He says it's not the heart that's in the driver's seat, it's the brain. And his research has gone after what most of us think about hydration during sports. He says we're obsessing over it and drinking way too much. And then there's diet. He says you don't need so many carbs, you need fat and protein. The truth is, Noakes has always challenged sloppy science and lazy thinking, and today in the program, he'll join us to talk about his work and his ideas. Along the way, we'll discuss eating better, drinking less, and running farther. Join us after the news.
The program you're listening to right now is made possible by more than 5,500 loyal public radio listeners. KUER sustainers give monthly contributions to ensure the station has a reliable source of income. So the next time you learn something new on Science Friday, or you're stuck in your driveway gripped by a conversation on Weekend Edition, give thanks to the sustaining members who are at the heart of the programs that you love. Become a sustainer today at KUER.org.
This is Radio West, and Doug Fabrizio. In setting up today's show over the last several days, our producer Benjamin Bombard was talking to a studio engineer in South Africa. That's where our guest, Professor Timothy Noakes, lives and works. And the engineer mentioned in so many words that Noakes is kind of a big deal, certainly in South Africa, but it turns out he's established a reputation as one of the most influential endurance sports scientists in the world. Some of you have come to know of Noakes through the writing of Christopher McDougall in his very popular books on running, like Born to Run. So that's where we'd figured we would begin today, with Christopher McDougall, just as a way of putting Professor Noakes and his work in perspective.
Yeah, I've known about Professor Noakes for a long time because anything that has to do with endurance sports, particularly running, he's this iconic figure. You know, The Lore of Running is like an 800-plus page book, which he revises every year with new information. So when it comes to state-of-the-art knowledge about running, it's the go-to guy is always Tim Noakes.
You say that one of the things that makes him really unique is his deep, this is how you put it to us anyway, deep immersion in athletics. What difference does it make that he's a runner himself, a serious athlete?
You know, because it's one thing if you're talking about something that you find out in a lab. It's another thing if you're actually testing it on the streets. And I don't mean to disparage the New York Times, but if you ever look at any kind of newspaper article about exercise science, it always ends with kind of a shrug, like, well, we need more research or we're waiting for more information. Mm-hmm. And what sets Noakes apart is if he's advocating something, you know that he's just going out and run 56 miles in the South African heat to test it himself.
Right. One of the things that's so interesting, I think, about Noakes is his willingness and maybe even eagerness to challenge conventional thinking. Have you been able to identify what it is about, you know, about his disposition or maybe his personality that sort of has motivated him in that sense to sort of go after conventional thinking?
That was one of the things that really intrigued me about him, because when you meet him in person, he is the most courtly, genteel gentleman and does not seem at all like the kind of guy who would be irreverent. He seems the exact opposite. He seems very old school, very traditionalist. Yet he does have that blood scent in his nose to sort of go after giants. And you know, in particular, I think his biggest battle to date has been when we went through an era, and you still hear it today, where people are constantly advocating, make sure you drink, make sure you hydrate.
Yeah.
And what Noakes found out is actually that the drink giants, these giant drink corporations, are pushing people to drink more than is actually healthy for them, and they're doing much more harm than is good, particularly in long, hot races. So he was a guy that led the charge on that. And what I became intrigued by is wondering, you know, where did this come from? And then what I discovered about him is his own personal history. He has a father and a brother who were, number one, in the tobacco industry back when people were being told to smoke. Smoke a lot is good for you.
Yeah.
And secondly, they themselves died of diabetes-related conditions. And I think those two formative factors really made him this gadfly, this guy who wants to go out and kick the tires, make sure things are the way they should be.
Another one of those things he has challenged is the role of carbohydrates in endurance sports. Just give us a sense of that quickly, because he's really changed his thinking on carbs over the last few years. I mean, he was one of the first, if not the first, to talk about carb loading in endurance races.
You know, I had no idea that Dr. Nose was actually involved in this discussion until I started to research it myself. You know, I was curious as to whether the paleo diet that was becoming fashionable was actually related to good science. And when I started to look into it, one of the first names that popped up shocked me, which was Noakes. I thought, is it the Tim Noakes? Because he is the godfather of carbohydrate loading. The reason why every marathon has a pre-race pasta dinner and people eat bagels and oatmeal before a race is specifically because of the research done by Dr. Tim Noakes back in the 1970s. He's the guy that advocated this idea that you need to load up on carbohydrates in order to have a good effort in an endurance race. And it's become sort of coin of the realm. So when I see that Noakes is involved in the paleo diet, I start to look into it, and I come across this really kind of earth-shattering speech he gave where he called a press conference and said that, I'm sorry, I've done a lot of harm to a lot of people. It was my fault, I was wrong, and I'm sorry. I've never heard a scientist say this. You know, there's always a qualification. He just stripped himself bare and said, I was horribly wrong. Carbohydrates are a poison, and we need to stay away from them. And since then, he's become a real virulent defender of a high-fat, low-carbohydrate diet, the very guy who advocated it 30 years ago.
Do you have any sense, Christopher, whether, I mean, I know some of those positions have earned him, you know, a decent share of critics. Can you say what kind of damage this might have done to his reputation?
It's really hard to assess right now because there are two schools out there. There are the grassroots people who have adopted what he calls a Banting diet. Yeah. He refuses to put his name on it. He believes that it's a much more traditional diet than he deserves to get credit for. A ton of people, uncountable people, have really benefited from this diet. And the people who have turned against him are the people who have revered him for 4 years. The top scientists who believe that anything Noakes said was golden really started to ridicule him, deride him, and to this point are actually sort of pushing disciplinary actions against him.
Yeah.
So again, it's really surprising that people who shouldn't be supporting him are, and people who should be paying attention to his science are really scorning him.
Let me ask you one more thing. One of the things that I find really interesting and almost a theme in his work over the years that's kind of remained consistent, and that is his thinking about his revelations about the importance of the brain, the mind, really, in athletics and the role that it plays. Say something about that, finally, if you would.
That was one of his big revelations, the central governor theory of exhaustion. And again, it's kind of an intriguing idea because when you think about the human body, essentially it does have a machine-like function. You put fuel in and energy will come out. And what Noakes discovered is the sense that a human is way more resilient, way stronger than we actually believe. But the crucial function is, number one, equipping the body with the proper caloric input. But number two is having that confidence to believe you can do more than you think you can. So, again, Noakes is starting to challenge this whole idea that exercise is kind of bad for you, that you can get hurt. And his point is, no, you can push way through, that the limits are boundless for exertion. Again, it was a novel theory. It was derided, but now it is starting to come into the mainstream.
It's Christopher McDougall. He's the author of the books Born to Run and Natural Born Heroes. He spoke to us from his home in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. When we get back from a break, our conversation with Professor Timothy Noakes. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West and Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, a conversation with Professor Timothy Noakes. If you're a runner, you've probably heard of him. Earlier on the program, we heard from the barefoot runner Christopher McDougall, who says when it comes to endurance sports, no scientist is more influential or respected as Tim Noakes. And Noakes has built a career on challenging conventional beliefs, including his own. He's joining us now on the program. He's the retired Discovery Health Professor of Exercise and Sports Science at the University of Cape Town in South Africa, where he's currently Professor Emeritus there. He's also the founder of the Noakes Foundation and the author of several books. We'll mention some of them as we go along, including The Lore of Running and Waterlogged. And Professor Noakes is joining us today from a studio in Cape Town. And Professor, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Doug, and thank you for all the hard work you did in finding out about who I am and that lovely interview with Chris. It was just fantastic. Thank you so much.
Yeah, it's our pleasure. I wanted to begin by talking about this time early in your academic career. You came to study into the United States, to Los Angeles, on this exchange scholarship. And it was at this point when Chris Barnard was conducting the first human heart transplant. And it's been said that this was kind of a defining moment in your life. And I wanted you to talk about that, that this in some way was really influential in the way you were thinking about your professional life.
Absolutely. I owe a lot to America because that was an amazing year I had. It was 1967-68, which was just such a year of change throughout the United States, throughout the world. And I was fortunate to be in Huntington Park High School, and it was just an amazing school with this diversity of people, and I had a fantastic time. And while I was there, we were driving back from Capistrano to Los Angeles with the family I was staying with, and it was 3 o'clock on Sunday, December the 3rd, the afternoon. And I heard on the radio the 3 o'clock news. It said the first human heart transplant has been performed in Cape Town, South Africa, by a South African doctor. And I just couldn't believe it. And then a week later, Chris Barnard was in America, spoke on television, and I was just amazed at what a great speaker he was, how lucid, how calm, and it just, he inspired me. Because at that time, I didn't really know what I wanted to do with my life. And literally 3 months later, I woke up one morning in Huntington Park, Los Angeles, and my brain said to me, you will study medicine at the University of Cape Town. And that was it. And I decided to do that. Because I learned to listen to my brain when it tells me such important messages.
Right, right. Well, the brain is a theme, and this was something that we'll dig into the details as we go along. But this idea of the brain, the mind, and its influence on the things we do and the things we feel like we can't do. Do you feel like that is an overriding theme in some ways in your work?
Yes, because the second great moment, or the more recent one, was when I'd just finished writing Waterlogged, and I'd sent it off to the publishers in the United States. And I hadn't been running enough, and I went out and had a terrible run. And when I came back, on the email, there was this suggestion for a book called The New Atkins for the New You. And I looked at it, and I said, this is bogus. I mean, we all know Atkins is a shocker. He tried to kill us by telling us to eat saturated fat. And then I noticed the three authors, Finney and Westman and Volek. And I said, but these three guys are great scientists. They wouldn't have sold out. So I said, but did they sell out? So I wanted to find out. So when I bought the book, I read it, and that changed my life. Because then I realized that I'd been teaching the wrong information on diets, particularly for athletes. And that was the second time. And really was within 2 hours of reading that book, I realized, this is it. You made a terrible error. You better change. And so those were the two moments that my brain told me it's time to do these things differently.
I want to come back to this particular story because I think it's interesting. And it's interesting to hear the reaction to it. We mentioned a little bit of that with Christopher McDougall, but we'll come back to that. Because there's been a lot of pretty intense reaction to this, but also some of the other ideas. So we'll get to that. I want to back up to running. Because this is another really important theme in your life and something that you're really passionate about. In 1973, you first ran this really famous ultramarathon in South Africa. It's called the Comrades Marathon. And in your book, you say that it took three runs at the marathon before you came to fully understand what you called the depth of that experience. What do you mean the depth of that experience? Because you write about that that depth a lot. I see that a lot in your writing.
Yes. I think you have to first know South Africa, that in South Africa, a marathon is kind of thought, it's like a 10K race. It's thought to be too short, that we raised to run this particular race, which is just an astonishing race. It's 56 miles, and it's very hilly, and it's very tough, and it gets hot. But there's a huge audience following, and today it's on national television for 11 hours. Wow. So it's become one of the epic sporting events in South Africa. But when I ran it in 1973, it was quite the opposite. I think we had 2,000 runners, which was a huge field for those days. But it's nothing compared to the 15 to 20,000 that you get today. And it takes you into a different space. And I remember running in 1973, I entered a new world with about 20 miles to go. And I just touched heaven that day. I ran so well, and I got this runner's high, which I'd often had, but this was one which was beyond anything I'd ever experienced. But I think the message I got was, a year before that, I could not run 3 miles at the speed I ran the 56 miles on the hills. So I couldn't run 3 miles on the flat at the average speed that I ran the 56 miles in the race. And of course, I'd trained incredibly hard and been incredibly committed to this cause. But that taught me that if you really want something and you really commit to it, you can achieve things you could never, ever have believed possible. Literally, 3 years before, I saw people run a 35-mile race, and they showed me the medal for breaking 5 hours. I said, it's impossible to run 35 miles in 5 hours. But 3 years later, I was doing that with ease. You know, I was running it under 4 hours. So, but at the time, I thought it was utterly impossible, and I couldn't conceive it. But that's what happens. If you go out there and you train yourself and you're committed, you can achieve things that you just never believe possible.
You write, in that perfect solitude on the road, at the point where fatigue drives each of us back into ourselves, into those secluded parts that we discover only under times of duress, do we emerge with a clearer perspective of who we really are. You've written a bit about this as well. Those moments when you're pushed to the limit, that's when you find out who you are. Would you talk about that?
Well, it happens in every race. You reach a point where you have to make a decision. Am I going to push through this, or am I going to quit it, or cut back at this point? The problem in the comrades is it happens 3 hours before the finish. So you've gone three or four hours, and you know you've got 3 hours more of this discomfort to put up with. And that's when there comes a moment, and in every race there's this one moment, and you decide, am I going to stop now, or am I going to continue?
Yeah.
And for some reason, if you push through, it never comes back again, and it goes. And then you know, okay, fine, it's going to be hard, but I'll be okay. And this quitting moment, I don't know what it means, but it's definitely there. But the point is, you live with yourself for 3 hours, and you have all the time to be making reasons why you're there.
Right.
And if you don't know why you're there, then, of course, it's more difficult to continue. So you really discover what you hold valuable and how you see yourself. And you learn never quit. That's what the real lesson is. You learn whether or not you're a quitter.
Running showed me that life is self-competition. Is that how you think about your life?
Oh, yes. I was involved in team sports, and at the time I didn't really see the value of team sports. Now I do, because I've worked with teams, and I see that there's a huge value to team sports, because in certain sports, every single player has to give 100% or the team will fail. So I understand now. I didn't understand it at that time. But in the individual sports like running, it's really up to you, and you have to make the decisions, and you can't blame anyone but yourself. And I think that's a terribly important message, that your outcome is determined by how hard you train and the effort you put in, and then the mental strength that you bring to it. And there's nothing else that's important. That's it. You've got to make the decisions for yourself, and you can't call on anyone else. In your moment of dire distress, you can't call on anyone else. It's only what you carry with you in your brain that's going to get you through it.
What does being a runner, or an athlete in general, how did that change your perspective as a scientist, as a doctor, as a researcher? What kind of different perspective do you think that brought to you?
Well, I think that really was critical. Firstly, I had to study medicine. That was important. But in fact, I never really became a medical doctor. I was always a scientist.
Yeah.
So let's start with that one. So I got into medicine, and I really didn't have much interest in chronic disease. I was interested in preventing disease and understanding sports medicine. And so when I was listening in the lectures, the only thing I was listening for was, what relevance has this got to do with sport? So that was, I spent my 6 years in medicine interested only in what was the outcome that was relevant to sport. And then when I left meds, well, then when I did my internship in the hospital, I realized that science was what really interests me. So I went into science. And at that time, I was already running Comrades Marathons and ultra distances. And it just gave me the physical experience that you need, because you can't really understand endurance sports unless you're in them and experiencing them. So it gave me an understanding. And then that introduced me to all the runners who they would ask questions. Mm-hmm. And that led, for example, to Waterlogged, because someone asked me this real question, why did she nearly die in the Comrades Marathon? And so I had my finger on the pulse and I was interacting with athletes. And I learned all of law of running was taught to me by athletes. And if I hadn't been actively in athletics, I wouldn't have learned it. So I think that's the key. You have to be immersed into the activity to really understand it.
When you first considered sports as a field of study, what was medical training like? What was the science like about sport? You talked about it was at best kind of ambivalent about sports.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, two things happened to me. I got a chronic injury of my knee, and I went to see the orthopedic surgeon, and he said, "Well, you complain you get pain when you run 40 kilometers. I've got patients who can't walk 4 meters. You know, so what's your problem?"
Right.
One of my great friends won the Comrades Marathon 5 times. He's Jackie Meckley. He's a little older than me. He's in his 80s. Just an amazing man and fantastically healthy and fit at his age of 80. He said to me he had the same problem because he got an injury. And also, like at 40 Ks, he got struggled. So the doctor, he went and said, "Well, why don't you just run on your hands after that?" That was the level of care we had in sports medicine at the time. But I was also very, very lucky because 1968 did a lot of things, politically a lot of things changed in 1968, but sport changed in 68 because it was the Olympics in Mexico City, was at altitude. And it was the first time there was a real issue of, here was a physiological problem. What happens if you exercise at high altitude? And no one knew. So there were a couple of teams, like us, the Americans, they sent teams to Mexico City to train and worked on their physiology. And so did the British. And I'm sure the Germans and everyone else did. But that was the first time there was a real physiological question that had to be answered. And so we got scientists addressing that question. It was also the first year that East Germany competed. And by 1976, they were equaling the performances of the United States. So it was during that period that there was a sudden interest in sports medicine for political reasons, but also for other reasons. And so I was fortunate because in 1968, literally, you could know everything about sports medicine. It was such a tiny field.
Yeah.
So I got into the field when it was possible to know everything about it. But today it's impossible because it's now become highly specialized in many different areas. But I think it was fortunate for me because I got a general understanding of sports medicine. The field has just exploded since then, and it's really exciting to see all the fantastic work that's being done in many different sports and in different body organs. We just know so much more today than we knew. We really knew nothing in 1968.
There's this story that you've written about this moment. This was, I think, in spring of 1969, and you were a medical student at the University of Cape Town, and you were also on a rowing club at the time.
Mm.
And this British Olympic rowing coach visited your club, and he offered this kind of lesson, which seems to be kind of this metaphor for thinking about sports and endurance. I'm not sure if you can remember the story that well. I sometimes put people in this. Would you talk about that? Because I think this was such an interesting kind of moment of epiphany for you, it seems.
Yeah. And again, it comes back to my experience at Huntington Park, because I played a little bit of American football. And one of the guys who was a really good player, and I really liked him, and at the end of the season, I asked him, "So tell me, what are you going to do?" And by the way, he went to Utah. Huh. He went to Utah University. Brigham Young University in Utah. And he said he's going to Brigham Young. And I said, what are you going to do there? He said, I'm going to row, or crew, as you call it. I said, you know, Brian, that's an amazing idea. I think I should do the same. So when I arrived at Cape Town, because I'd never done any endurance sports at all, I'd all done the typical British sports. And so I went immediately to row and started, and they were really supportive. But fortunately, this coach came out from England, and he gave us a lecture, and I can still see him at the blackboard. And on the he had an X and a Y axis, and on the horizontal X axis, he had distance rowed, and on the vertical Y axis, he had blood lactate concentration, and it went from 0 to 10. And the distance was from 0 to 2 kilometers or 2,000 meters. And he sort of drew a straight line of lactate just rising at a very high, fast rate. And he said, ladies and gentlemen, this is why you feel so tired when you're rowing, is because your lactate levels go to these sky-high values. And I can remember walking out of that lecture across the university campus and saying, that's amazing. That's what I want to study. You mean you can measure something in the body that predicts your fatigue? The linkage was just amazing. And I said, that's what I'm going to spend my life doing.
Mm. It's what you did.
Exactly. And in the end, we came to disprove the theory that lactate had anything to do with
right,
fatigue.
Right. Which gets me, I think, to the kind of this next point. And another, seems like, anyway, to me, theme in your life, known for challenging the norms. I mean, challenging beliefs, as one of your book titles puts it. Mm. How do you describe that disposition? Do you like challenging conventional thinking? Is there kind of a sense of skepticism? Is it defiance? Is it self-confidence? Have you figured it out?
I don't think it is actually defiance or self-confidence. It's just when I see something that is wrong, I'm the one of the first to see that it's wrong. And I just get this feeling, this sort of funny feeling in my body. And I say, but this isn't true. What this person's saying can't be true because I know something else that disproves it. So when I teach students, I say, I don't care if you've got 1,000 facts supporting your hypothesis. If you've got one fact that doesn't fit, you better throw that theory out. And what I've discovered, many professions, and increasingly today, it didn't used to be so when I was in my education in the 70s, increasingly today, you're not encouraged to question. You're told to just regurgitate all the same information. And so that becomes the real problem for me. And it's got worse. And so there's more errors being taught than there were, I think, 20 or 30 years ago. So my point is that if I'm reading something and the person does an experiment and they come to a conclusion which deviates from their data, then I start to question. And the other one is the paradox where they can't explain quite what they find because they're stuck in a model. And that's the key. You have to have a model of how you think the body works. And that model then determines what you believe. But as soon as you find something that conflicts with the model, the predictions of the model, you have to ask the questions. For example, this is a simple one. If you go out and exercise in Salt Lake City, it's quite high. And you'll never reach the same blood lactate levels as you will at sea level. So you say, but hold on, but I'm more tired in Salt Lake City when I run. I run slower and I feel worse. But my lactate's lower, and that's called the lactate paradox. And it's been known, the lactate paradox has been known since 1936. And no one questioned, well, hold on, if it's so difficult to run in Salt Lake City at altitude, and your lactate's low, well, then lactate can't be the problem.
Yeah.
But we've known that since 1936, but no one questioned it. And I got the old stories with, oh, but the muscle can't produce lactate under these conditions. But that's not the point. The point is you're exhausted and you haven't got lactate being produced. So how can you explain that by lactate?
That's been such a critical sort of question for you. It seems like that's the important thing. You've talked about the fact that for you, coming up with that right question was an important starting point. And I guess this was one of those important questions. And it's sort of one of those – if you also sort of came up with this discovery that there isn't – there was this sort of plateau phenomenon, as it was called, this idea that when where oxygen consumption, when it reaches its peak, that a person's muscles run out of oxygen, and so they just physiologically can't go any further. It's a physical phenomenon. But you found that that's not true, that there didn't seem to be a plateau, in fact. And so if there's no plateau, why does an athlete stop? I mean, so I guess these are the questions you're working out.
Yeah, indeed. And so when I started, we had absolutely no money. So we had fairly archaic equipment. And we had to make these calculations and measurements. We didn't have machines spitting out the data with big computers and so on and so forth. And so we carefully looked at the data, and we could never, or we very seldom, maybe in 10 or 15% of athletes, we found that as we made them run faster, they did reach the so-called plateau phenomenon. Yeah. What was really interesting was at that time in the early 1980s, if you published a paper, you had to say 100% of the athletes reached a VO2 max plateau. Because if you didn't say that, then the paper got rejected because you hadn't pushed the athletes hard enough. So we had a choice. We had to say we had 100% plateau when we knew we didn't, or we told the truth. So we said the truth. And for a long time, that irritated people, and we couldn't get the papers published perhaps as easily as we might have. But we were persistent. And in fact, one of my students did his PhD 3 years ago and showed that the plateau phenomenon is, it just depends on the criteria you use. So if this phenomenon is just dependent on the criteria, it can't be a real biological phenomenon that is always present. So the point was, we couldn't see the plateau phenomenon enough to make us think that oxygen was limiting exercise performance. And that then made me think, well, okay, what else could it be?
Right.
And originally I came to the wrong conclusion, but finally, ultimately, we came up with a central governor model.
Which the conclusion was the central – I want you to talk about that. As Christopher McDougall was mentioning, the central governor idea is that it's your brain. It's your mind. That's the limiting factor, right?
Yeah. So what happened when A.V. Hill gave us this oxygen limitation anaerobic theory that lactate inhibits your muscles and so you get tired. But the problem was he didn't actually show that the plateau phenomenon existed, and we were able to show that. But the model he produced was called a catastrophe model. In other words, the human biology broke down catastrophically and you stopped exercising. Now, that completely contradicts what we teach in exercise or in all forms of physiology. And physiology is about homeostatic control, that everything is tightly regulated. Your blood glucose is tightly regulated. Your oxygen consumption is tightly – oxygen in the blood is tightly regulated. Your blood pH is tightly regulated. And that's a concept been around since the 1850s or so, this constancy of the internal milieu of the body. And what A.V. Hill came along and he said, no, that's fine for rest, but during exercise, it all breaks down. And I was the first person to make the point that this model doesn't work. How can we at rest be biologically controlled so that we don't fail, the body doesn't fail because of catastrophe? But when you start exercising, you get this catastrophic failure and then you're exhausted and fatigued. And so what we were able to prove was that when you're exhausted and fatigued, you're still homeostatically tightly regulated. You aren't close to death. And that then made me realize, amongst other things, that the brain is there to make sure you get to the end of exercise safely. And the ultimate proof was that you're never able to activate all the muscles in your legs if you're doing running, for example. When you're running flat out, at the end of a marathon, you're probably activating 45% of the muscle fibers in your lower legs.
Wow.
At any one time. So why not 100%? And the answer is if you did activate 100%, you'd drop dead or you might drop dead.
Yeah.
So the brain says, no, we're not stupid. We're going to make sure you only can activate 45%, and so you finish safely.
So is fatigue just taking place in our minds? In other words, that it's not necessarily related what's actually going on in our bodies, our muscles and our heart. It's our mind just saying, hold back because we might get too stressed. It's all in our minds, basically. Is that it?
It's an emotion. We call it an emotion.
Yeah.
And so you have to have this control that is going to prevent you killing yourself. And so the control starts the moment you start to exercise. And we know that because if we exercise in the heat and you just go out, or if we exercise you at altitude, or we reduce the oxygen delivery to your brain, you reduce your speed immediately. It's the system works within seconds of realizing there's danger. You slow down. So that's how the model works. It anticipates the future, and you slow down long before you get into trouble. And that is why very few people get into trouble, even when they run in the heat, because the brain tells you to slow down. Very few heart attack patients have problems exercising. As long as they listen to their bodies, they do fine. And at altitude, people don't die very often. They don't die because the brain's controlling it as well.
So how do you get around that? You have to fool your mind, sort of.
Yeah, what we tell people is that don't come off the field and tell me you're tired, because that's just an emotion. If you come off dead, yes, then I find you were tired. So we tell people that you never have to listen to what your body's telling you, what your brain's telling you, because it's just making it up. It's a fairy tale. You don't have to believe it. And what we're finding now with our newest research is that the elite athletes, the moment they realize they're going to win, they actually become much less fatigued. And that's why when you watch the winners come across the line in big races, they look perfectly happy and relaxed. And we suspect they actually feel less discomfort than the guy who comes second or third. And we know the guy who comes second has the worst pain and discomfort. And so it goes on.
So the training, the crucial training, physically getting prepared, of course, but there's also mental training here, it seems like, involved.
Yeah, I think that's what great coaches do, is that they prepare you to believe that you can do something. But the effect of winning and losing is so profound, it overrides everything else. So that's what our work seems to show, that you change your whole emotion and your physiology the moment you start losing or winning. And we know of examples of winners who just say, well, the last 5Ks was the easiest 5Ks I ever ran in my life, and that's an Ironman triathlon. How can it possibly be that at the end of the race, you just get this elation and you don't have any fatigue? So that tells us that there's a discrepancy. But the other point that tells us a discrepancy is that athletes always speed up at the end. So if you run a 10K
right.
or a 5K, you always speed up in the last lap.
Yeah.
And so the question is, how do you do that? And we know your muscles are slightly more tired than when you started. But physically, you feel tired. And you would say, gosh, I'm exhausted. But yet you run faster. So it can't be, the fatigue cannot be physiological. It has to be in your mind.
What about an injury? Or what about a cramp, say? Is your mind creating that cramp to tell you to stop? Is that in your mind too?
I don't think it's always in the mind, but what we do know is that if you have an injury, it may well be that it cramps up to make sure you don't damage yourself. So we do think that there is some evidence that cramping occurs in muscles which are at their limit, and they may well become injured, and as a consequence, you slow down, or they slow you down to prevent a serious injury. Yes, there is that evidence. Generally, cramping occurs in people who push themselves harder than they really should. They're not really trained for it. And it is a neural or brain or spinal cord mechanism that we know. In other words, it's a nervous system problem. It's not because you ran out of salt or you ran out of water. It's definitely a nervous system problem.
So drinking pickle juice, that's just nonsense.
No, it's not actually.
Oh.
And that's one of the paradoxes, that if you do put pickle juice on your tongue, your cramps go away quicker. That's scientifically proven. What that tells us is that as the pickle juice hits your tongue, a reflex goes up to the brain, and it tells the brain something, and the brain says, okay, well, you can stop the muscle cramp. So there's really good documentation that works. But it's not because the salt gets to the muscles. It's because the salt activates a brain reflex that then reduces the cramping.
Wow. Timothy Noakes is with us. He's a health and fitness researcher and an emeritus professor of exercise and sports science at the University of Cape Town in South Africa. He's joining us from South Africa today. We need to take another quick break, but we'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West and Doug Fabrizio, back now with Professor Timothy Noakes. He's the author of a number of books. You may know The Lore of Running, if you do run. He's also the author of Waterlogged. His latest title is Real Meal Revolution. And he's joining us from a studio in Cape Town, South Africa. Professor, let's talk about another subject where you've challenged conventional thinking, and that is the amount of water we drink, particularly athletes. You say our culture has become obsessed with water. What do you mean?
Well, I think we've become obsessed with sports drinks, certainly,
right.
And then water perhaps is the next consequence of that. You see, I grew up in the 70s when we used to run without drinking very much. When my first marathon I ran, we had water provided at 20 miles, and that was it.
Wow.
If you wanted more fluid, you had to find a way to get it. And I can remember running behind someone in that race, and he suddenly veered off and went and lapped up the water in a pond, in a puddle, because it rained the night before, next to the road. He ran off the road and drank some water from a puddle. So I think he was quite thirsty at that time. But, I mean, that's the attitude. In fact, one of the first things I tried to do was to get water introduced into marathon running. And we were so successful that by 1981, in the Comrades Marathon, which is this 56-mile race,
yeah,
they were providing fluid every mile of the race. So we went from the first time I ran Comrades, 1973, I think I had 5 drinks during this 56-mile race, and I probably drank 100 ml every time I drank. So I probably drank 500 ml and had a great run, etc. So we went from that to 8 years later, fluid was available every mile. So we had 56 seconding stations. And during that race, a lady developed a low blood sodium concentration, and she nearly died. She lost consciousness. She was treated by the doctors at the race finish, who said, well, she's obviously dehydrated. She needs more fluid. And then she went to another hospital, fortunately, and they realized that there was something wrong, but they weren't going to give her fluid, and they saved her life. But it took her 4 days to regain consciousness. And when she did, she wrote to me, and she said, Doc, what happened? And I wrote back and I said, I've no idea. This has never been described ever in the history of running. And I then started researching it and managed to find 4 or 5 other cases. And by careful interrogation of the runners and working out what had happened, I concluded that they'd all drunk too much and that they'd retained the water. So the title of the article was Water Intoxication, a Possible Complication During Ultramarathon Running. Mm-hmm. And that was at the time that dehydration was considered to be the killer. It was also 1985, which was the very year that Gatorade started to promote the sale of their product. And so you can imagine that a sports drink doesn't want to think or want athletes to believe that it's possible to drink too much. And so we then started a 20-year battle, mm-hmm, with the sports drink industry in the United States. Because they were pushing their drinks, and we were saying, hold on, it's dangerous. And by 1991, we had proved by really good research that the problem was entirely due to fluid overload. It had nothing to do with salt deficiency. So taking salt wasn't going to stop the problem. You had to not drink to excess to make sure you didn't get this problem. And I predicted in 1991 that the first death would be in an American female marathon runner. And 2 years later, it happened because I'd worked out who's likely to get it, slightly smaller athletes running 5 or 6 hours who drink every few kilometers for the whole 42 kilometers. And if they're running slowly, they've got time to drink. And I thought maybe women will be more likely to run slowly. They're also smaller, so they're much more likely to get it. And I knew because the doctors didn't understand that water intoxication is what will ultimately kill you. When the patients came in confused, they would say they were dehydrated and they would give intravenous fluids.
Wow.
And so the prediction unfortunately came true. And it was really only in 2002 when Cynthia Lechera died during the New York City Marathon and the autopsy said that she drank too much fluid. That sort of the bubble burst and people then started taking me seriously. And by 2007, the American College of Sports Medicine changed their guidelines and they said you must drink only to thirst, which was the precise opposite of what they'd said in 1996, when they said you must drink as much as tolerable. And those words were the problem.
It's so interesting, this reaction that you get. You've called it scientific gullibility, this inclination to resist something that challenges conventional wisdom and conventional thinking. And clearly this came up. We'll come back to this question that you started talking about a little bit earlier, and that is this idea of low-carb diets, which you resisted, but then you really changed your thinking on this. Was scientific gullibility playing a role in diet? Has it been? I mean,
over absolutely. The, yeah. So I had profound gullibility because when I started in the 1970s, that's when the muscle biopsy technique came along. And people in Scandinavia started measuring muscle glycogen. And for the first time, we had something that disappeared during prolonged exercise. So if you started with a lot of glycogen and then you dropped your glycogen at the end. So everyone said, well, you see, it's obvious. It's when you run out of glycogen, you get exhausted. And so we'd reduce, that's called reductionism, scientific reductionism. And because it was so exciting and it came out in the 60s when exercise physiology was just becoming novel and of interest to people, we all fell for it. And so we started telling people, well, it's glycogen that's the most important determinant of performance, so you've got to get it high, and that means you must just eat carbohydrates.
Yeah. Carb load.
So that was the gullibility, and I fell for it terribly, hook, line, and sinker. And I did for 33 years until I had my own epiphanous moment. What is the opposite of gullibility is reverse gullibility. And that is not seeing when the evidence is there to show that we're wrong, you don't accept it. And that's the problem today. So there is so much good evidence that high carbohydrate diets are damaging the health of many people, including many athletes. And we don't see it. And the evidence is abundantly clear. But it's reverse gullibility that's preventing people to change their minds.
What do you make of the reaction to it? I read this article, for example. This is what it said about you. It said, a once solid sports scientist has now veered down the path of quackery by pushing his low-carbohydrate, high-fat Banting diet. Do you get a lot of that kind of reaction? And did you?
Absolutely.
Yeah. And what do you make of it?
Well, I don't worry because I know that probably a million people in South Africa have adopted this diet. Because they write to me and they phone me and they tell me it's the best thing that ever happened in their lives. And the truth will out. And the reality is that South Africa is the first country in the world where this dietary change has been adopted almost like a virus by the general public. And there are so many people who have benefited and they are telling their friends. And their friends are saying, gosh, you lost 10, 15 pounds or kilograms. And they say, gosh, I've got all this energy and I've got rid of all these conditions. My hypertension's controlled. My diabetes is being reversed. So all these things are happening and you can't stop it. It's like a wave. It's a tsunami that's spreading through South Africa. So the people who are saying that I'm a quack, are unfortunately going to be proven completely wrong. And they're the ones who are going to be discredited in the long term because the evidence is abundantly clear. And it grows moment by moment that the biggest error we ever made was to go to this low-fat diet in 1977. That has had catastrophic consequences for our health. It is the direct cause of the obesity diabetes epidemic across the world. And the reason is it's biology. The biggest problem in the world is insulin resistance. That is the greatest problem. So I like to say, people, you don't have diabetes, you don't have high blood pressure, you don't have heart disease, you have insulin resistance. Right. That's the underlying problem. And the only way you can manage insulin resistance, you can't reverse it, you can manage it by cutting down your carbohydrates. And what we're doing in medicine, we're treating the symptoms. We take the hypertension and we take medication, or we take the diabetes and we take medication. But we don't address the cause, and the cause is the high carbohydrate diet in people who are insulin resistant. And that's the biology. And that's why I know in the long term I have to be right, because the biology is correct.
Two types of people, you say, those who are carbohydrate tolerant, those who are carbohydrate resistant. And I guess the trick is trying to figure out which of those you are. I can't imagine it's that hard to figure that out.
No, it's very simple. If you have a bad family history of diabetes, like myself, you're likely to be insulin resistant from a very young age. And If you start to put on weight in middle age, that's a very good sign of insulin resistance. And then there are a whole bunch of blood tests you can have. And probably the best is the glycated hemoglobin or HbA1c value. And if the value is about 5.5, you need to cut your carbohydrates and you will not get sick. You'll be fine. People like myself waited till we had values over 6.5 because we were stupid and ignorant and ate too much carbohydrate. It drove us into diabetes. So, diabetes doesn't happen overnight. It takes 10, 15, 20 years. And if you catch it early, there's no problem. But the cure is simple. Cut the carbs, no sugar, and eat real foods and eat lots of fat and you'll be fine.
Well, you're retired now, but I'm guessing you still feel engaged in all of this. Are you anticipating a next step, another piece of conventional wisdom you want to challenge?
Yes, the next bit of conventional wisdom is that you can't reverse type 2 diabetes. And so we've got two studies about to start in which we study people who have so-called reversed their type 2 diabetes on the start. And there are hundreds of thousands of people around the world who will tell you that they've reversed their diabetes. We don't know if it's true, but we want to study the biology. And the next one is to see if you can just use a diet to reverse a type 2 diabetes, if you catch it early enough. Obviously, we want to prevent it, but if we can prove that we can reverse it, we pull down one of the pillars of modern medicine, which is that diabetes is an irreversible condition for which you just get sicker and sicker and sicker and need more and more medication. That is not true. Every day we see people who reverse or completely control their symptoms and their blood glucose level, abnormal blood glucose levels, by just changing their diets. So we can beat diabetes. We can beat obesity.
It's Professor Timothy Noakes, Emeritus Professor of Exercise and Sports Science and the author of books Waterlogged, The Lore of Running, Real Meal Revolution, joined us from a studio in Cape Town, South Africa. Professor, thanks very much for the time.
My pleasure. Thank you for such an intelligent interview. It was amazing to speak to you, Doug. Thank you so much.
Thanks very much. Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.